Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with politics. In Massachusetts, will the GOP be able to field a slate of candidates in 2014? And is Joe Kennedy in trouble over his lone vote to back NSA surveillance? And coming off his rock star tour of Rio, the Pope says he won't judge gay priests. He won't? Was ex-Pope Benedict listening? Then Gene Rivers on open mic and the media's treatment of a killing in South Boston versus many in Dorchester and Roxbury. Then an update from the Moakley Courthouse. Will Whitey take the stand? And film critic Garen Daly on the anatomy of a Hollywood flop. We'll touch on the biggest of the summer and the biggest ever. That's all next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Brody. Marjorie Egan has the day off. She'll be here tomorrow, sitting in her place, standing in her place. Actually, is Sue O'Connell, who is the co-publisher, that being the operative word. I've learned that the co-publisher of the South End News and Bay Windows. You always like to mention the name of your other...
Jeff Coakley.
Yes. Okay. Well, he is not
co-hosting. Because he's in charge of the finances. So
he is?
I don't ever want him to say, look, you, Malone, looked right up there when he heard that. Huh?
Exactly.
Finances, I got an auditor right here, a man ready, treasurer ready to go.
Treasurer,
boom.
Actually.
I know,
speaking
I meant the whole thing.
Of
finances.
Malone, does the GOP have a future in Massachusetts? Does it have a future nationally? Do Democratic mayors and mayoral wannabes have some sort of disease? Is Joe Kennedy in trouble over his lonely, at least in Massachusetts, pro-NSA surveillance vote in Congress? Here to discuss that and much more is the former Republican state treasurer of Massachusetts, Joe Malone. Hello there,
Hello,
Joe.
Hello, Jim. Great to be with you guys.
Nice to see you, too. And Michael Goldman is a Democrat and the president of Goldman Associates. Nice to see you again, too, Michael.
Always a pleasure.
And by the way, in the interest of full disclosure, I have great disdain for Michael.
Oh, you do.
Yeah.
No, I said before we went
get
on
it
the
out in the open right away.
I said before we went on the air. I said to Joe, I said, "Do you two hate each other?" And you just answered the question, so it's fine.
Good. We're good. Well, we love everyone.
What did you used to do?
Yeah, that was in the last century.
Right. So our friend Joan Vinocchi, well, depending on whose friend she is, depending on what week it is, in yesterday's Boston Globe, wrote an editorial which is sort of the question on everybody's mind about what's up with the GOP on a statewide basis, on a local basis. Do we have candidates that can actually win? Do we have a party that can actually be an alternative to the Democratic Party? The best line in the piece for me was, in Massachusetts, is a top Republican anything like a jumbo shrimp? Mr. Malone, what's the story?
Well, it saddens me to answer that question the following way, but yes, very similar to a jumbo shrimp. The problem from a Republican standpoint is that the brand, the identity of the party now is really the Mitt Romney identity, which is corporate Wall Street as opposed to Main Street American Dream. And until they shift it over, then they won't get the number of candidates and the quality of candidates. They won't increase the activism at the local level. So for eight people to sit behind closed doors and decide that they're going to be the kingmakers, it really, to me, is a head scratcher.
That was a closed door. There was a conference right. call and a meeting where people like Bill Weld and Scott Brown was on the phone and Charlie Baker was on the phone. We should say, for those who are new to the state, when you were the treasurer, it was sort of the heyday of the Republicans in terms of statewide constitutional offices. Mm-hmm. You had three out of the five jobs, right? Salucci, Weld, and
myself.
You.
And then we had gotten as many as 15 senators, so we almost, we're knocking on the door to a
it was
majority of the Senate.
Senate,
right?
Yep.
Veto-proof. And the other thing I would add, too, is I saw the rebuilding from the inside because I was the director of the party when the whole renaissance began and Ray Shammy was the chairman. But it was that kind of blocking and tackling that needed to take place, and this party is doing none of that.
If you want to go to heaven, Michael, don't be a Democrat for a minute because your odds, I think, are fairly small of getting there. This may help. Advise state Republicans, because I happen to believe two-party government is a good thing for small-D democracy. What are they doing wrong that they could be doing differently?
Well, I would argue that we don't have two parties. I think we have a liberal Democratic Party and a conservative Democratic Party, and that's taken the place of the Republicans. But if you take a look inside the legislature, you have very distinct Democratic parties that battle each other. Ed King versus Mike Dukakis was that battle. Tom Riley, Lois Pines was that battle. So even though we don't have it in the Republican side, but I want to go back just a second, then I'm going to answer your question.
But if I may, that's not a replacement for a two-party system.
You know, but it is the way it is in this state right now for the reasons you mentioned. The real heyday of the Republican Party was 1962 to 1970, when Republicans like Joe Malone were electable. And I mean that in the kindest way. When one takes a look how Joe became the treasurer, he ran and lost the race against someone I was working for, Ted Kennedy. He ran a smart race. He ran a race in which he grew his brand. And in 1990, he was able to take that unsuccessful race and turn it into a successful race.
So does that mean Gabriel Gomez, following the Malone model, will be treasurer in 2014?
No, because Gabe Gomez didn't do that. Gabe Gomez, again, made the mistake that Joe didn't make of becoming too much of a partisan, a conservative in a state in which moderation is the key.
Joe, one of the things that you know, when I sat in on meetings with the Victory Fund, which is a gay and lesbian group to give money to gay and lesbian candidates, one of the things they say to minorities, and I think the Republicans in Massachusetts are minorities now,
indeed,
is you got to start small. You can't just run for the Senate and state the governor and state office. You have to run for city council. You have to run for president. You have to run for auditor, you know, town auditor, town manager. And when I look out around Massachusetts, I don't see the Republican Party growing candidates from that level.
But again, we were in the same position. It was 1987, and you had Andrew Natsios, who we ousted as the Republican Party chairman. We went in there, and it was just doing the hard work of sitting across a table with someone who, you know, might be the big wig in the Little League in New Bedford, mm-hmm. or it might be somebody who was with the Sons of Italy in Watertown. And he said, we want you to be part of this party, and here's why. And it's, you know, basically the Tip O'Neill blueprint. But this party, this Republican Party, it's raise a lot of money, throw some ads on the air, and hope that you win on
Jen
Election
Nasur,
Day.
Who appears with me on this program often.
Former chair of the state Republican Committee.
Won more races than anybody since Joe was at the party. What did they do? They removed her. I mean, that tells you everything. I mean, had a successful. And by the way, I was on the television show as well as on the radio. I did a number of things. She was articulate. She was. I didn't agree with her, but she was a great face for the party. And they shot her. How do you win when you take someone who's successful?
And part of the problem there is when you have 11% of the electorate, as the Republicans do, when you start to lose hope that you're going to win elections, then the infighting begins, and it's all about who's going to, you know, control this and who's going to control that within the party.
You know, I have to a degree, disagree with what Sue said about where you build from the bottom up or the top down. And in theory, you always build from the bottom up. Mitt Romney ran 101 candidates for state rep and Senate.
131.
Let me finish. Every single one lost.
131.
What Romney did brilliantly, and I think I mentioned this last week, I thought one of the primary reasons I think he was elected governor was that Gang of Three thing. You got a Democratic Speaker of the House. Yeah. You've got a Democratic Senate President, which we're still going to have for years to come. Don't you want some balance? And it seems to me that while ordinarily Sue would be right, the perfect opportunity where you had three felonious Democratic speakers in a row, hopefully there's no indication that the current speaker is going to make it four, the perfect thing is to have a credible, moderate Republican win the governorship with that same Gang of Three thing, and then it sort of trickles down.
But the problem with Romney, though, was that wasn't the Romney who got elected. That was the Romney who was serving, who looked for candidates who were anti-gay and couldn't ride the horse into the White House.
Speaking of anti-gay, the person who gets it, I think, in terms of recreating the image, Dan Winslow, who ran for the Republican nomination for the Senate, obviously lost to Gomez, filed a request with the Federal Election Commission. Ultimately, he lost originally. Then the DOMA decision came down, and he won when he refiled recently, basically saying gay couples should be treated just like heterosexual couples. When asked by the Washington Post, the Winslow, that is, Joe Malone, why'd you do this? He says, because I want to change the image of Republicans. Unlike what's happening in the United States Senate, where men who plan to run for president are
trying to get a bill through which would limit abortions to the first 20 weeks. Or Steve King, the Iowa congressman who refers to young people who come across the border as drug mules. Isn't what Winslow is doing exactly what needs to be done to reshape the image of the party?
I think Dan is on the mark in a lot of different areas, but the general approach that he's taken and that should be taken is both in tone and also in terms of policy. Recognize you're in the northeast of the United States, and the Republicans in places like Texas and down south are making it very, very difficult. So therefore, you need to make sure people understand there's a clear distinction between those kind of Republicans and these, because if they don't do it soon enough, people are going to say, why do I need all that brand baggage from the Republican side? I'll run as an independent, and I'll probably have as good or better chance of beating a Democrat and becoming the alternative. We saw it up in Maine. We saw it in Rhode Island, although he switched now to Democrat. But that's a real possibility in the near future.
That's the voice of Republican former State Treasurer Joe Malone. The guy who's about to speak is Democratic consultant and analyst Michael Goldman. Take it away, Michael.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that fundamentally is the problem, is that the Republican Party nationally doesn't care about Massachusetts or Massachusetts Republicans. Most of the Republicans that I know here in elective office are pro-gay rights. They're not abortion. They avoid the word. They're not crazy on guns. And the problem is in D.C., you have a party. We were just talking before we walked in here. You've got really three potential Republican candidates.
You're not going to tell us what happened in 1874 in the Republican Party. I just want to be sure.
We're going to go into the Whigs right now.
I can't tell you. Let me tell you, and you know this well, you've discussed it. Look what happens to Chris Christie. He's almost treated like some sort of an outcast among Washington Republicans, and they all line up to denounce him because that's their way of playing to their base back in their congressional district. So therein lies the dilemma.
We were talking before about the three segments of the Republican Party right now nationally. You've got Bush / Christie representing the Republican Party that is at least marginally
Which
sane.
Bush are we talking about? Jeb Bush? Okay.
Jeb.
Former governor
got,
of Florida.
We've got the libertarian / isolationist,
Rand Paul
and Ted Cruz. And in the middle, you've got sort of Marco Rubio trying to be reasonable on immigration but trying to be a Tea Party. But none of those three models fits an elected American presidential candidate in 2016.
Michael, the Democrats are as diverse. In some ways, our crazies are a little bit more crazy than their crazies. But our crazies get a lot. Of course, you do. Our party, I'm a Democrat. We tend to kind of get it together when we see the goal. And it seems like the Republicans want their flag to get over, their inter-party flag, rather than the whole team.
But see, where I would... I agree with your premise that the party is diverse. Where I don't agree, where I think the reason we win is the reason that candidates win.
Or we're unified. Why do we unify?
Because basically we're a party of choice. We're a party of reasonable gun stuff. We're a party of that's pro, you know.
That's
expansion.
Why the Democrats control the House of Representatives in Washington. John Boehner's the Speaker, not Nancy Pelosi.
But what we are in a presidential election is the party of majority of Americans. Each of the House seats is made up of very tightly woven constituency, many of which are conservative, but when you take a look at the overall population, not dictated by 435 artificial entities, Democrats beat Republicans on issue after issue after issue after issue.
Let's say one more thing in Washington, then I want to come back to some of the Democratic problems for a minute. If the Republicans, and there's a divide on this too, Joe Malone, end up shutting down government at the end of September, because their view is we cannot fund Obamacare for one nickel. Even if they are where the American people are, and a growing number of American people are not happy with Obamacare, isn't that a huge, huge mistake for them politically?
It is, and to their credit, a number of Republicans are saying it's a huge, huge problem. So I don't see it going anywhere, but the dilemma or the point that a lot of these guys want to make is to be able to go back to their districts when they're up for re-election and say, I tried to stop Obamacare.
Wasn't that the best thing is to vote irresponsibly and lose, so the good thing happens? I mean, that's like you see a lot of people. When I used to be a lobbyist, and I use the term loosely, on Beacon Hill, you'd see a lot of people on the far right or the far left wait to see if the responsible position passed. And as soon as it passed, they cast the vote for the other position.
A very cynical approach, absolutely.
But that does happen.
You know what? I want to ask you three men one question each before, because you're all very enlightened.
We're all men,
okay,
yes.
I'll start with you.
That would be Michael Goldman.
The 20-week abortion ban that's in play down is the 20 weeks. When do they start counting the 20 weeks of pregnancy?
I believe at ejaculation.
Okay. Jim, when do they start counting the 20 weeks?
That response so shocked me. I'm sorry. I can't answer now.
Mr. Malone.
I have no idea. Is that the answer to the question?
The answer to the question is that there is no scientific measure of unit to start to count when the 20 weeks begins. So I guess you're right.
It is.
I guess
that's
by
the
default.
Answer.
And here it's we
Michael's
have a bunch of men
expertise.
In Washington who are trying to put forth law which doesn't have a basic scientific basis. Well,
you know, one of the most dramatic photographs I've ever seen on the front page of the New York Times was many years ago when George the Younger was president of the United States and he was signing some restriction on abortion. The photograph was the president sitting at his desk signing the thing, and he was surrounded by, I'm guessing, 15
white
members of Congress.
Yeah.
Everyone was white. Everyone was in their late 50s, early 60s.
Great crew.
And whatever. Yeah. In any case, since we've been ganging up on the Republicans,
yeah,
Michael, now it's
just
your turn.
Democrats, yeah.
Here is one of the favorite mayors of Democrats across this country. This, of course, is the man of the headlock. He's the he's San Diego Mayor Bob Filner. He's at press conference this past Friday. And while he's owning up to his sexual misconduct, you'll hear he has a little bit of a microphone problem.
Beginning on August 5th, I will be entering a behavior consulting counseling clinic to undergo 2 weeks of intensive therapy to begin the process of addressing my behavior. Apologize for the inconvenience. For the sake of, I guess, those who want a clean tape, I'm going to start over.
So he has this heartfelt apology that he's got to read twice. Now, ordinarily, my attitude, Michael Goldman, Democratic Michael Goldman, is the sins, particularly when they're condemned by leaders of the party, the sins are sins of individuals. When you have in the same week this guy who served in Congress for 20 years, Filner, who's putting women staff members in headlocks and then groping them or speaking, raising sexual issues, and then you have the most laughable man in America, Anthony Weiner, in New York City, with some of the great headlines. You see the New York Daily news headline?
It's every day.
The schlong and and the short of it, so to speak.
Yeah.
In any case, does this not trickle up or trickle down onto the party?
It does. And I was pleased on Sunday to hear so many people say overtly what every member of the any reasonable person, I don't care if they're Democrat, Republican, Independent, there's no way that Anthony Weiner should be a candidate. I personally believe there's no way that the former governor, Elliot Spitzer, should be a candidate. And certainly
Controller
this guy
in
San Diego. I mean, the question I have, and it's a kind of interesting one to me, is as bad as what they did is, they it's almost as though they have no sense of the embarrassment to their wives and their children and their put the party aside. Why in the heck would he have run knowing that after the time he was thrown out that he had engaged in similar behavior? I mean,
arrogance.
It's arrogant.
It's more than just the arrogance. I mean, you know, people have to have a big ego to run and do what we all do.
It's partly arrogance, but it's partly people around him who will benefit by him running saying, look, Bill Clinton, you know, he's a very popular politician now, and he certainly had his problems. And Sanford, he, you know, just got elected to Congress, and he certainly
former
had his problems.
South Carolina and, with
and,
the Appalachian
and we'll work
trail.
Our way through it. Well, now, when, of course, you got
but Larry Craig couldn't.
You got Weiner then, who it's not, you know, we're going to give you a second chance. He wants a third chance.
That's
So he's really to the extreme. But the other guy, Spritzer, he's liable to
I'd
get elected.
I'd like to say for the record that I did look at the text picture of Weiner just so I could be a good journalist. And I would like to say God bless him for his aspirational ideas about himself. And secondly, just as a public service to everyone, the only people that want to look at pictures of other men's private parts are men.
Women don't want to look at it.
It's a male-oriented.
Well,
it's a
playgirl.
Why don't you go around the room and ask three men how they feel about that, too?
Playgirl was for gay men. It was not for women.
If straight men would just send those pictures to gay men, the world would be fine.
You know, I'm so glad you said what you said, Michael, about the potential damage to the Democrats, because I was sure you'd say the opposite. And I was talking to some Democrats this weekend, and they were, in my opinion, total denial. If Filner is Filner, Weiner is Weiner, they're both.
They're wrong.
This is no different than what happened when all those members of Congress were saying incredible things about abortion during Romney's run for the presidency.
If you don't see that this – but not only that, we're – you love to say Democrat Michael Goldman. I love to hear Democrat Michael Goldman because I think the party has values. One of the values it has is – my two daughters, who are 34, who are attorneys, have an equal opportunity to compete despite the fact that they're women. It's a party which says whether your sexual orientation is gay, straight, bisexual. To see these guys label themselves something which I think is exactly the opposite of what the party stands for. And I'm sure, Joe, you feel the same way when Republicans get caught doing crazy things.
But I think it's selective. And I've seen it be selective on both sides. And I mentioned, to point out a Democrat, Bill Clinton's name before. And it was even now wasn't stepping up at that time and saying this girl was an intern and you know you're
when you
the
were
president
state treasurer just to clear the air you never put any employees any employee in a headlock is that correct Joe Malone?
No, and I always wore men's clothes.
Okay, can we let's talk about I think some potential more problem for some Democrats. Here's journalist Glenn Greenwald appearing on ABC News this week with George Stephanopoulos. Remember, he's the journalist at The Guardian who broke the Edward Snowden information about the NSA. Here's Greenwald.
The story I've been working on for the last month that we're publishing this week very clearly sets forth what these programs are that NSA analysts, low-level ones, not just ones who work for the NSA, but private contractors like Mr. Snowden, are able to do. The NSA has trillions of telephone calls and emails in their databases that they've collected over the last several years.
And he goes on to say that low-level people can access the content of the phone calls, can access the content of the emails. We're talking to Michael Goldman, Democrat, Joe Malone, Republican. It seems to me, to bring this back home, there was a vote last week that was stunning, Michael Goldman, to me, that by a very narrow margin, an effort to shut down the NSA surveillance, at least one piece of it, vis-a-vis email, was defeated narrowly with this odd coalition of libertarian Republicans, liberal Democrats. The one lone vote in favor of the NSA and surveillance was Joe Kennedy, the recently elected congressperson from Newton and surrounding places. Does this have some pain for him in the future?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think that And I have to stop by saying I was strongly in favor of the vote, which would have shut it down. So that's my predisposed
bias. The losing vote, the narrowly
losing vote. So I start with that. So my position was against a young Joe's position. I think that the ultimate problem for those of us who believe that is that someday, horrifically, as we all know, something's going to happen in this country, some attack, and they're going to say, if the liberals and the libertarians hadn't shut it down, we could have caught it. And I think for Joe Kennedy, if you read what he said, he wasn't convinced, quite frankly, although I am, that limiting this, in fact, would keep us safe. Now, that's a judgment that each individual makes.
I think you've talked about it, Jim. You know, the president gets into office, every president, and says, I want to do this and that to dampen down things, and then sees the terrible things that, you know, like Gitmo is a perfect example, and then gets, you know, this is a terrible thing that could happen, so I want to increase... whatever we're doing.
You have to fight
fairness,
every day.
Let me expand on what Michael said a minute ago. Here's from the Globe story by Jim O'Sullivan. The Brookline Democrat, meaning Joe Kennedy, said he opposed the amendment because after meetings with intelligence officials, he concluded that the NSA's previously secret initiative to track hundreds of millions of Americans' phone records had prevented terrorism. What's your take on this, Joe Malone?
Yeah, I don't think it hurts him because, he's aligned with Obama on it, so he can say, hey, I supported my president. B, as someone said, you know, look, I don't want to see Americans die. My concern, and if I was advising him or anybody else in Congress, I'd say, we won't even outsource custodians at a high school. We're outsourcing this stuff. You know, we've got more consultants now. You know, that's crazy.
Well, that's the difficult part of this whole Snowden, you know, whatever side you come down on it, that these type of people, if I can speak generally, tend not to fit into a box. And as folks were upset about Snowden's background and him being a, you know, sort of a, so many jobs he had been through and
high
sort
school
of a,
dropout.
And, hey. But at the same time, these are the people that you have to hire to do the job. So I would be more concerned, to your point, about seeing stricter guidelines to have to hire these hacker
Absolutely.
Geniuses.
And I want to go to Jim's point, which is this. The idea, with all due respect, that Halliburton continues to be the main resource for so many of the things. We just had it with the oil rig. Whatever happened to the government being responsible for what the government is supposed to be responsible for? This idea was saving money. Then who do you blame? There's nobody. And this NSA story is so awful for the reason you just picked up. So, you know, you turn around and say, who gets fired?
And
well,
again, just
the consultants, the non-government employees.
Just for the record, I believe there are a lot of places where privatization, you know, that kind of outsourcing makes sense. But this is one where these agencies have gone way overboard in terms of, okay, we met you on Tuesday, you're here working on Wednesday, and we're going to give you all of this vital information and highly secure information. And
hey, Joe, you ran for Congress a few years ago. How would you have voted if you had been down there on this NSA thing?
Tough call. It would have been a close call, but I think I would have worked to put some sort of an amendment to reduce the number of consultants, but say let's make sure Americans are safe.
So you would have voted with Joe, Kennedy on this thing.
Yes.
You know, speaking of members of Congress who may have some issues they have to confront, in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm sure you do in a minute, one of your closest friends in the world is John Tierney, who just won a congressional election over Richard Tesei by what, a percentage point? And the House Ethics Committee announced the other day they're continuing an investigation of four members of Congress, the highest profile being Michelle Bachmann. The most local is John Tierney. Is this a problem for your guy prospectively?
Well, honestly, it's not in the following way. He has been pressing for this to get to the committee for months. He has already been investigated. The IRS looked at him. The U.S. Attorney looked at him. If there had been anything there, he would have done it. The only way we get this behind ourselves is to get into this committee and get it dismissed. And unfortunately, it's taken all this time from the election to now just to get it into the committee. But this was not like the Bachmann one in which it was taken kicking and screaming. This is one, as he said in his quote to the Globe, I've been trying to get this in here because there's nothing here and I want it done long before the election. But Michael, you know more about this than I.
But isn't this the kind of case where everyone says, the analogy is not perfect, so my apologies in advance. When a politician is accused of a crime, and he is not accused of a crime,
anything, they
say, oh, I really look forward to the opportunity to clear my name. I can't wait till the trial starts.
Well, this is a little bit different because he's never been accused of anything. So it's very hard to fight when you actually have never been accused of anything. In this case, it's a tax question.
You mean legally?
Legally, or in any other way, yeah. I mean, except for his opponents. This particular question is a simple one. Was the money that Patrice Tierney received a gift? And if it was, it's not liable to any taxation.
His wife from her brothers,
right? And the IRS has already ruled that in the case. That's why she was never tried for that. They found that it was in fact a gift. There was innumerable amounts of evidence to show that it was a gift, and I'm sure that's what the committee's going to decide.
And some would argue, though, that this investigation is a gift to the Republicans. If you had said to me who was the one Democrat who was going, I said it at the time, who was going to lose the Republicans statewide, federally, etc., and I was with everybody else, that Richard Tesei, former state senator, was going to beat John Tierney, he lost by a point. That, to me, was the worst sign for the future of the Republican Party. If they can't win that race, every editorial board endorsed to say, yeah. How much damage does this continuing investigation do, if any, Joe Malone?
Here's where I think the damage occurs, and that is he now has two primary opponents, Tierney does.
Two Democrats.
Exactly. So if there were two primary opponents in the last election cycle, then Tesei wins that. And I do think that it creates a lingering problem for him that as the incumbent congressman up in the 6th District, more money will go into the challenger as Republican because that dynamic exists.
How about that? He does have two Democratic challengers.
He does, and he has said he can have as many as he wants. I personally, this will be resolved long before then. This will be off the table. And then Richard Tesei has to run to say what is fundamentally different between himself and John Tierney. And as you pointed out, he couldn't win when he had John Tierney's wife to kick around. When she's not there, what does he run on? John Tierney, for good or ill,
another difference, it won't be a presidential year, yeah. And the turnout will be more favorable.
Nobody wants to bet me. Nobody wanted to bet me last time. And I
all right, what's the bet? I'll take
anything
the bet.
Anything you want. Dinner? We'll go
sure.
For steak. We
all
both
right,
steak
very
men.
Good.
Do you have to go together or will you go
separately?
I think you should be
you
very
good. I'm going to enjoy dining in front of him and then handing him the bill. Okay, you got to
absolutely.
Save that tape. One last thing. Speaking of your point earlier, Michael, about two Democratic parties. Governor Patrick just won, and I'm using the word carefully, won $500 million in new taxes from the legislature. It seems to me that strategically he ended up with the worst of all worlds. He ended up getting a tax increase. This is for his transportation financing bill, but basically said it's not enough to solve the problem. So he wasn't able to claim victory in that, you know, saying, listen, we finally have money to fix the roads and bridges that you can see all around you are falling down or about to fall down. But at the same time, people's taxes are going. How do you think he handled this thing?
Well, you know, again, Patrick Finn, as you know, I know you have him on the show here all the time. I think he genuinely believed what he said, and I think he fought for what he believed in, and he didn't want to leave without at least having the fight. I would have preferred if he had done it the first year or the second year of his first term, then he would have had some skin in the game. I think what killed him
He tried raising the gas tax. He couldn't do it. They ended up with a sales tax increase, 20% sales tax increase.
We've 25%. Known for a while that this deficit, and particularly in transportation, and as Joe knows, transportation is as important for the development of the economy as anything else that you do, because without good transportation, people can't get to work and can't get to the places that you want to do.
But making this state affordable and allowing people to get to and from work without having to give a huge percentage of... I would have much preferred to have had a governor who said, you know what, there's plenty of fat in this state budget. I'm going to find a way in which to make this government run more efficient, more effectively, more innovatively, and let's leave the taxpayer alone.
I would only say in response to that two things. Number one, that's what Weld, Salucci, Swift, and Romney did for 16 years. We never got anything cut. And number two, even more important, I think what is essential here to remember is that for the legislature, they're running for re-election, and they need to know when they put themselves on the line, the person proposing also has, again, skin in the game. And I think that hurt him more than anything, Jim, the fact that people said, well, this is great for him to do now for his legacy, but, you know, what does it cost him if we end up losing? And as you well know, the Massachusetts is now 24th
in
the state.
He's pointing to Joe Malone, not me.
24th in the state and in the country in taxes. That ain't bad. 24th place is not bad to be lowest taxes.
Well, those figures can get manipulated in lots of different ways.
Getting back to one thing, the waste and inefficiency thing, I think the point that Michael made has some legitimacy. Every candidate who has ever run for statewide office, I've lived here 30 years, was going to eliminate all the waste and inefficiency in government. Who's the most? Mitt Romney was going to do it, and so he eliminated it by raising $700 million in fees. It's all, no one ever does. I mean, with all due respect, does anybody, Republican or Democratic, elected official, ever do it except on the margins?
You know, at the risk of sounding self-serving here, we went in, and year after year, we spent less than we spent the previous year, to the point where after 8 years, our budget was 62% smaller than when I arrived, not adjusted for inflation.
62%?
62%. And by the way, when I stated that, Democrats would say, well, you succeeded Bob Crane. You had a, you know, your office was filled with lard. Well, how many other offices are filled with fat?
A lot, and I don't want to bring up a horrible memory, but weren't a lot of the problems that you were not personally responsible for happened because there was no oversight left?
That was absolutely false.
You know what it was?
Now they're not going to have dinner.
No.
We'll still have dinner.
Okay.
Honestly, it was, and by the way,
I think it hurt you unfairly, but it was...
By the way, it was a guy who went to cash a check thinking he was going to be smart enough to embezzle it, and the system was such that the bank said, no, that's too big of a check. You can't cash that. We're calling over to the Treasury. End of story. It had nothing to do. All those... I'll give you a quick example just to show you. We had couriers, state employees, everybody's nephew and niece from, you know, the politicians. Instead of doing that, we put it out to bid... FedEx, UPS, all the rest of them bid on it. We ended up saving $2.5 million a year, and the service was better. Those kind of things can and should be done. And unfortunately, Massachusetts, bigger government is sacred, and you can't touch it.
Okay. But then they were unemployed. Then our unemployment rate went up because those couriers had no...
But it's not government's role.
Hey, listen, we've got to go. I just have one question. Will you both, will sign a permission slip so that we can record your dinner together?
Yes.
Is that something?
I want the specific steakhouse. Yeah. He's liable to bring me to some dive. No offense, over in Malden. They poison me.
A great steak.
Hey, Joe Malone and Michael Goldman, thanks as always.
Pleasure
to see you both.
Smith and Lewinsky.
Happy summer.
The Palm. The Palm is good.
Joe Malone is the former state treasurer. Michael Goldman is president of Goldman Associates. Like President Obama, could the Catholic Church be evolving when it comes to gay rights? Signs point to yes, in light of Pope Francis's recent comments. The conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When it comes to healthcare, the mouth isn't always considered part of the body.
You know, we have a long history of separating oral healthcare from overall healthcare. Dental care is a very marginalized issue.
And for MassHealth patients, dental care comes or goes with each budget. I'm reporter Ibi Caputo. That story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Boston Landmarks Orchestra Summer Concert Series, bringing free music to the DCR's Hatchell every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. This week featuring A Night in the Tropics, landmarksorchestra.org. And It's Your Move, Inc., a move management company specializing in the planning, orchestrating, and execution of moves for senior citizens, helping families sort through and organize treasures collected over a lifetime. It'sYourMoveInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and the South End News is sitting in for Marge Regan. Hi there, Sue.
Hey, Jim.
So I think most of you know, for decades, the Vatican has called homosexuality a disorder. And in that spirit, the prior Pope, Pope Benedict, said gays could not be priests. Well, his successor, Francis, in the last 24 hours at a press conference said, quote, "If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?" Who are you to judge?
You're the Pope.
But in any case, is this a blip, or does Francis's pronouncement on his way back to Rome from Rio rank up there with the overturning of DOMA by the Supreme Court? What does this mean for Catholicism and gay rights? If you're Catholic, give us a buzz. If you're gay, Catholic or not, what do these words mean to you? I'm not Catholic, and I'm not gay. I think it's pretty huge,
I should say. It is.
Particularly contextually, Pope Benedict is alive. Pope Benedict is a buddy of Pope Francis. In fact, in the same press conference, he not only praised Benedict, but said he loved having him around and he would like him to be more public. But for a guy, matter-of-factly, like this, to say what he said, running up against the tradition of ages, is, I think, a really big deal that'll have ramifications well beyond the walls of the Catholic Church.
Without a doubt. I mean, it's a number of gay Catholics have already sort of left the church or started their own version of worship with a group like Dignity, which is gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender Catholics who continue to be Catholic, obviously outside of the Roman Catholic business part of the church. But, you know, this Pope has, in short order, already changed the entire dynamic of being Pope. Well, he is famous for his devotion to helping those in poverty, and he came to the Vatican and is already saying, "I don't want this, I don't want that."
Remember, he's washing the feet of young prisoners.
Yeah, he washed the feet. He wouldn't go to a big concert that was in his honor. He had homeless people come to the Vatican for a meal. So he's already walking the talk and sort of revisiting the issues that some believe Jesus Christ was really all about. And a number of gay Catholics, and I'm not a practicing Catholic, but I've said, listen, if he takes care of poverty, I can take a weight on the gay issues. If the only thing the Pope does is deal with the recommitment of the Catholic Church to poverty, I'll pass on everything else. But here he comes out and says in a very clear and direct and undeniable way that whether you're gay or not, he doesn't really care. And especially with the church, you know, with the priest part, where we've had, certainly here in Boston, we know in the Boston area, the issues of the abuse of the priests of children, the rape of children. The gay stuff gets caught up in that because it's an aggressive behavior which manifests in a homosexual behavior.
And often confused that sexual predatory behavior, when in fact we know that close to a third of the survivors, the victims of these priests, were girls, by the way.
Right. So he's able to, with one sentence, just sort of separate that from all of it as well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. What do you think about what the Pope had to say? It was deliberate. He held a press conference on the plane, as I say, going back from Rio to Rome. And they make a point in almost all the articles, the Associated Press is the one I read, that while there have been press conferences in the past, for example, his predecessor on a plane would go reporter to reporter and talk to them one-on-one so that other reporters couldn't hear. This was a wide-open press conference. Everybody was there, regardless of their view on the papacy and on this particular pope, said he could not have been more open. accepted questions, was not instantly. I don't want to fawn over this. He did say when he was asked about the ordination of women priests, quote, mm-hmm. the door is closed, end quote, on this issue. But I have to say, it's one step at a time. I sort of agree with you. He's taken on the poverty issue. I don't think many of us thought he was going to take on the issue of gay priests. Now, it may be an acceptance of reality. If Margie was here, I think what she'd say, I don't want to speak for her.
You can't have a priesthood without gay priests.
Exactly. I mean, it's... And so maybe he's just recognizing reality. But whether he is or not, I think it's a big deal. 877-301-8970. Catholic or not out there, what was your reaction to what the Pope had to say? How long has he been in his position?
It's not even been a year. It's been a few months. And you have to remember that the prior Pope, you know, we in the gay community always had a sort of tragic whistling in the graveyard kind of laugh at his expense. He had on red Prada shoes. The first thing that Ratzi did when he took office was he had his tailor fired because his robe was too short during his coronation.
Ratzi is short for Ratzinger, is that what you're calling him?
You know, so he's, and now he's retired on the property with a nice, buff, young, you know, priest who's sharing his abode with him. And we're like, you know, they've got the gay mafia idea going there, that there's this undercurrent of
that was the basis for the question, by the way, is about the infamous gay lobby, as it's been
called.
There
was a website in Rome that catered just to gay priests. I mean, there's all this ridiculous gayness, which
but there's one thing,
Pope.
But I think you'd agree, it's one thing for there to be a reality that is different than the face. It's another thing for the Pope to acknowledge the reality to a great degree.
Yes, and he's not saying what his predecessors have said, which is it's an illness, it's terrible for children, you know, it's a terrible sin, and this is a complete change.
In fact, Pope Benedict XVI, he signed a document in 2005, the Associated Press story says, that said men with, quote, deep-rooted homosexual tendencies should not be priests. So it was a big day in the last 24 hours. What's your take on this? Let's start in Roxbury with Michael. You're on with Sue O'Connell and Jim Browdy on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Michael.
Hi, everybody. How are you?
Good,
excellent.
Michael.
I actually completely agree with what Sue said, that when the Pope addressed the moral bankruptcy of the ultra-rich in our world and how that affects everyone else, especially the most poor, you know, the poorest among us, I could take a pass on anything else that he had to say because this is a worldwide problem and has been for a long time. But the disparities of rich and poor are just atrocious, and there is a real true moral bankruptcy around that. But I don't think in the United States existed 100 years ago. But with regard to what he said about homosexuality, I think that it's great that he did. And I think the part of just as poor people are ghettoized and all different kinds of people are ghettoized, gay people in many parts of the world are also ghettoized. And
including in the Catholic Church for a long time.
Yeah, but, you know, the issue with gay rights, which I think is different in a lot of, and I think maybe the corollary to some other types of discrimination is that once we sort of get equal, we're not in your face anymore. You know, it just sort of goes into the common fabric. If we can find...
And then you can talk about issues that actually matter.
Yeah, if we stop... If the energy that we put into, you know, trying to get marriage equality in this country could be put into pick the issue of your choice... We would all be better for it.
Hey, Michael, I'm sorry, you have another thought?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, once you get rid of these things from the socio-political discussions in our country or the world, then there is time and lots of money to talk about things that actually do truly affect everyone.
Michael,
sexuality does not affect others. Mm-hmm.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. You know, it's interesting, I'm thinking, that at the same time that Pope Francis is down there in Brazil talking poverty. And by the way, siding with protesters against the government of the country that he's there, basically, who are protesting over these kind of inequities. You know who was talking about the exact same issue? Barack Obama. And the question is, did Obama come close to having the same impact in his talk about the horrible impact of these financial economic disparities as did the Pope? I don't think so. By the way, here's Pope Francis addressing 3 million people at the Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro yesterday. He spoke specifically to young churchgoers. Here it is.
La Iglesia precisa de vosotros.
The church needs you, your enthusiasm, your creativity, and the happiness that characterizes you. Three words. Go without fear.
Sin miedo,
para servir.
And most people think the go without fear comment is to the protesters, mm-hmm. you know, stand up, be strong. 877-301-8970. Let me say something I know is going to come out as totally ageist, so I acknowledge that in advance. This guy's not a kid.
No.
Also, he's wading into crowds of tens of thousands of people, putting himself at physical risk with an
difference.
Energy level that is unbelievable.
This is what happens when you have someone who lives with the people. I mean, and he has always chosen to be with the people and not be behind the wall. It's funny, I always think of Jerry Seinfeld in times like this because he says it's really hard to be a comic of the people when you're making $1 million an episode. And it's the same thing when you're, you know, supposed to be serving the poor and you don't have any worries.
So did you say you're a lapsed Catholic? Is that
yeah,
what you said?
My daughter's baptized Catholic.
So does the behavior of this
absolutely.
New pope potentially get you back in the fold?
I don't know if it gets me back in the fold, but it definitely, and it, for me, and I'll be totally frank, the poverty issue for me is much bigger than the gay issue, and it's the biggest issue in the church. And I, for me,
and by the way, this is from the voice of the co-publisher of the largest gay, lesbian, bi, and transsexual publication.
I can live my life without. I can live without the Catholic Church accepting me, but I do. You know, it disappoints me and angers me when an organization like the Catholic Church, built on the ideals of one would think someone like Jesus Christ and the Bible, where you treat those who are least among you as best you can. It's the poverty is much more important.
You know, by the way, one of the things that was hardest to understand at the same time that news was breaking about what's happening in this archdiocese, what is it, 10, 11, 12 mm-hmm. years ago, I was spending time on Beacon Hill, and I'd remember the moments when Cardinal Law, who was atop this, essentially, this pedophile ring, for mm-hmm. lack of a better expression, prior to knowing that, there was no more eloquent spokesperson at legislative hearings in defense of the rights of poor people than he was on behalf of the Catholic Church. And so there are these odd, I guess,
dichotomies. Yeah, absolutely.
But with this guy, at least so far, obviously the women issue, he's still not quite ready for. And I think a lot of people would say he hasn't done what he has to do for survivors yet. But he's been there, as you say, less than a year. And I think he has made tremendous headway. Let's go to Brockton, where Greg is on the phone with Sue O'Connell and Jim Browdy. We're talking about the Pope's declaration about gay priests. Hey, Greg.
Good afternoon, and I would just say I'm not a Catholic myself, but I am a Christian, and I believe in the Bible because it's God's word. I thought Catholics also believed in the Bible, and I mean, it was two popes back, and I apologize for not remembering his name, the one
John Paul,
yeah,
who preceded Benedict, that actually said gay adoption did violence to children. Mm-hmm. Those were his words. And the Bible says that the practice of homosexuality is a sin.
No, it doesn't.
And there are other sexual
Greg,
sins,
it doesn't. It doesn't. If you're talking about Leviticus, then you need
no,
to...
There are many passages.
Never. It's not.
You're
going to have to... It's not. Homosexuality, of all the things that are mentioned in the Bible, homosexuality didn't even make it into the Ten Commandments.
You see, in a way it does, because when you talk about honoring your father and mm-hmm. your mother, in fact, the very first institution created by God in the Garden of Eden was that of marriage. It predates
Greg,
government.
Greg, do you believe in the literal Bible? I want to make sure I understand which Bible your interpretation. Is it the literal?
Say which Bible?
Do you believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible? Is that your belief? Is it the
yes, because it's
all right.
God's
so how
word.
Do you how do you deal with God, Leviticus? So,
look,
did you have shrimp last week?
that includes the New Testament.
Yeah, did
you're
you
forgetting there's the New Testament?
They don't mention shrimp in the New Testament.
And you see, the new covenant was brought by Jesus, and all of those dietary restrictions.
Okay, how many times did Jesus?
Now,
how many times did Jesus mention homosexuality?
Hey, Greg, rather than having a Bible fest, which I think you're losing, Greg, we're in 2013. And there are a lot of things that change. I mean, as Sue said in her tease, this Barack Obama evolved on gay marriage. The Pope is evolving on this issue. What do you think about it in 2013?
What do I think about the issue?
No, what do you think about what the Pope said in the last 24 hours?
He's out of touch with God's word. In fact, the book of Hebrews, New Testament.
Greg, thank you. Okay, I'm not up for a Bible lesson, but
basically.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the
call.
I
would agree with the Pope's infallibility on this
point. This issue, exactly. 877-301-8970. And specifically, by the way, since I brought up the whole issue of women before, in one of his most important speeches in Rio, again, reading from the Associated Press story, Francis described the church in feminine terms, saying it would be, quote, sterile without women. Asked what role he foresaw, he said the church must develop a more profound role for women in the church, though he said, quote, the door is closed to ordaining women to the priesthood. I'm assuming if you were to ask in 2005 when Pope Benedict said what he said about gay priests, we're not going to hear in our lifetime something like we heard yesterday. Maybe within our lifetimes we'll hear something
about women,
too. But
also, you know, his work on poverty affects women almost more than it affects men.
Yeah,
you know?
But the notion, as someone who isn't a Catholic, the notion, but I am sort of a lapsed Jew, and I would occasionally, even though I was not an Orthodox Jew, go to a synagogue where the women had to sit upstairs while the men sat downstairs. When you treat women as second-class citizens in this regard, even if you're treating them as, quote, equals and all others, the inequality still stands. But again, I am like you. My attitude is there's been such tremendous progress in such a short period of time. I hold out a lot of hope, and I'm usually a glass-half-empty kind of guy on everything, as you know. Dave, you're in Fall River. You're on with Sue O'Connell and Jim Brady. We're talking about the Pope's comments on gay priests. Hey, Dave.
Hey, I just can't let the shrimp thing go. In Mark chapter 12, verse 7, Jesus declared all foods clean.
Oh, okay, good.
So it takes care of that.
Thank you.
From the earliest days, Christians distinguished between the ceremonial law and moral law.
Okay, good.
And Jesus, Jesus, if it's in the Bible, Jesus speaks it because the teaching of the church is that God is the author of the Bible.
Yeah,
the word
no,
of God.
I get that part. Yeah,
so you just opened
you
up a can of shrimp,
so declared homosexual acts anyway as immoral.
What was the beginning of that sentence? I spoke over you. What was the beginning of that sentence? Homosexual acts are immoral. What was the beginning?
Homosexual acts are immoral.
He says it says that in the Bible.
Okay, go ahead. Next.
Yeah, that's in Romans 1, chapter 1.
It says that very clearly. It says homosexual
Do you think the Pope has not read the Bible, Dave? What's your sense of this?
Well, my sense is this. I follow these issues very closely, and there's been a big brouhaha about this. But the truth is that it's the official teaching of the Catholic Church, and it always has been, and even Pope Benedict spoke out about this, that, you know, gay people should be treated with dignity and respect, and there should not be undue discrimination against them. And I don't quite see
Dave, you got to hold a second. I'll tell you, because shortly prior to Benedict, popes were calling this, the Vatican was calling homosexuality a, quote, disorder. And to go from disorder to if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge? I would say that's a bit of a sea change, at least in my non-Catholic estimation. But, Dave, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Kristen in Attleboro. You're on with Sue and Jim. Hey, Kristen.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks.
What I wanted to say was that even though I am not a religious person myself, I do believe in virtue. And one of the cardinal virtues is reverence, in which people do not believe that they're higher than God. The Pope is still definitely a human, I hope. And so he's saying that who am I to judge? This is God's issue, not mine, almost. That he's being reverent enough to realize that he does not have, like, the final word when it comes to who is a good person and who is not, regardless of their sexual orientation.
He does, but he also does have, he's infallible, you know, which is another part of being Pope. So, you know, and I appreciate that he's taking that tone because it says a lot about him as a leader and a person, but it does carry more weight than just a human saying it.
Right, and also, maybe I'm reading a little bit differently than you, Kristen, but his words are so carefully chosen. If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge? I mean, I think that's about as positive as a pope in 2013 can get. Kristen, thank you for the call. Let's go to Stone, where Peter is on the phone. Peter, you're on with Sue and Jim on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Peter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I feel like I'm a cynic in this. I appreciate what the Pope said. I think it's wonderful that he's choosing not to judge people, many of who feel that they don't have a choice about who they are and their sexual preference. But I don't see how it's going to really drive doctrine or change anything differently. The analogy I have is it's kind of like saying, you can smoke marijuana, you just can't grow it, sell it, own it, or exchange it. So he says he's not going to judge anybody, but how is that going to change any policy?
But Peter,
you can be gay, but you still have to be celibate the entire time?
Well, you still have, if you're going to be
celibate,
a priest, you
yeah.
still have to be celibate anyway. So that's sort of, that is what it is.
Gay,
it doesn't
yeah.
matter what you are. But Peter, don't
so
you think, don't you think by, well, because, you know, as you pointed out, being gay or straight is not a sexual behavior, it's an orientation. So whether you're straight or gay, you don't have sexual activity when you're a priest. But don't you think by his just saying it, he's changed? I mean, this may be all that happens. I agree with you. He may serve out his life as Pope and nothing else changes, except this might be the very first step in it changing long term.
You know, but also, Peter, before you respond to what Sue has said, virtually every caller is called speaking as a Catholic, and so a lapsed Catholic. I'm speaking as neither lapsed nor ever a Catholic. I think the impact in the world is potentially profound, Peter, when the leader of this huge church it makes a comment that virtually none of us expected, when the world is debating issues of equal rights for gays in their countries. I think it trickles down into almost everything. I mean, I don't mean there's going to be a sea change tomorrow, but it creates an environment that is a far healthier and far less divisive, I think, when it comes to gay rights. I'm sorry, Sue.
Well, it's just you could just say he's the most powerful person in the world. I mean, you know, we don't often see the impact of the Pope, every Pope, on the day-to-day life. But in some parts of this world, he is the most important person.
But, Peter, I interrupted. Do you have a final thought?
Yeah.
What
We've
is it?
Changed
Go
your
ahead.
Mind and you agree with us.
The thought is, does this is this largesse really just restricted to priests, or is it everybody who is gay?
That's a very legitimate question, Peter. I don't know what the answer is, but I assume we'll find out in the days ahead. You know what I love most about this, beyond the content, the fact that the guy. If you haven't seen the photograph, mm-hmm. you got to search yeah. for the photograph. He is leaning on seats in the front of a cabin as a reporter or reporters are holding microphones, asking questions, ducking nothing. It's just like mm-hmm. like a regular press conference that somebody would have. And unlike most politicians who don't answer the questions, if you read what he said, he answered virtually every question
yes.
directly. And I thought it was a great
He's refreshing.
Advance,
he's definitely
really,
refreshing.
He is.
Well,
in any case,
you sound very enthusiastic.
Well, I'm a big critic of the Catholic Church. I don't want to, you know, portray myself in any other way. I have, you know, on my Facebook page and in Bay Windows and in the South End News, you know, one of my favorite questions to people who are being anti-gay is that very Christ-like? You know, is that what Jesus Christ would do, you know, just to open the conversation? So I am relieved to not have to, you know, cover more bad news about the Catholic Church. It is a relief. And it also says a lot to Jim's point, to a lot of gay and lesbian children around the world.
That's a great point.
You know, who don't live in Massachusetts, who live in areas where their life is in danger. To hear the Pope just say, hey, you could become a priest if you're a young boy who's gay, is an amazing, powerful statement. So,
Peter, thanks for the call. It was a great
thanks,
call.
Peter.
And now, next, on to the survivors of pre-sexual
yep,
abuse.
Hopefully,
but we'll
yep.
give that a little bit of time, but not too long.
When we come back, we'll check in with someone who always has something to say about civil rights, and I'm sure he'll correct my interpretation of the Bible as well if I need some help there. That's Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. He joins us next for Open Mic on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
I'm reporter Ann Mostu. I live in Boston, and I bring you news from Boston.
Rob Vandermark is an owner at Ride Studio. He's troubled by the deaths of five cyclists in Boston and at least one outside the city this year.
I'm here because I'm passionate about finding the truth and giving voice to the people in our community.
I've been on country roads where I've had cars throw things at me. I've had country roads.
Ann Mostu, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and New England College of Business and Finance. NECB offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu. And Skinner, presenting Asian art online through August 6th. The online-only auction offers a diverse selection of Chinese, Korean, and Japanese decorative arts, furnishings, and antiques. More info and online bidding at skinnerinc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is off. She'll be back tomorrow. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows South End News is sitting in. Joining us as he does every Monday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Actually, he usually physically joins us in studio. It's like a force of nature coming in. Today, we'll see how it goes. He's in Princeton, New Jersey. He's on the phone. He is the Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Hey, Gene, how are you?
Hey, people. How are you doing?
Excellent. Thank you.
Doing great. Doing great. Reverend Rivers, I want to talk to you about sort of the media coverage as carefully and as with great care as we can around the murder, abduction and murder of Amy Lord last week, which, as Bostonians know, was this terrible situation of a young South Boston woman who was abducted in the morning on the way to the gym, taken to several ATMs where she was forced by her abductor to withdraw money, and then viciously stabbed to death and her body dumped in Hyde Park. And it's for those of us who live in the city and cover the city and deal with urban issues, it's horrific. It's terrible that her friends and family are going through this. But at the same time, there are murders that happen and violent attacks that happen in areas of the city that just don't get the same amount of attention. The feeling from the media sometimes is just what is a more likely story to resonate with people, what has a larger impact on the public safety. What's your feeling on how the media has covered this and what the public attention to it has been?
Well, first, I want to express publicly condolences to the family and the friends of this innocent victim. I just want to do that first, right? And I want to say as sensitively as one can that, you know, on the one hand, we have this absolutely horrific tragedy, which is in many ways just very exceptional. So as a news story, you know, part of the explanation that I've heard is I've raised the question of balance, because over the weekend I talked to a few friends and some folk in the media, and I said, last year, three girls were murdered on Harlem Street in Dorchester. This year we have this tragedy. And I asked myself the question, and friends, I said, is it fair to ask if there's a question of balance? And I'll tell you, I had an amazing conversation from two young white women from South Boston, very, very sharp young women. And we were in the Tedeschi's and Fields Corner on Dorchester Avenue. And I asked them what they thought about the incident, the tragedy. And what they pointed out, which was sort of interesting, was that there were a number of deaths where women were murdered in South Boston that got none of the coverage of this most recent tragedy. And so for them, the issue, they acknowledged that, you know, what happened, unfortunately, in Dorchester last year on Harlem Street was a tragedy. But what concerned them is that there had been a number of deaths in South Boston, and they were essentially poor women who were faceless and, for the most part, nameless. So there was a class issue for them with regard to the coverage. Now, I talked to a few people in the media who said, well, there's something to be said. On the other hand, the argument which wasn't quite pushback was, it's such an exceptional case, that such a violent, you know, tragedy, and to some extent for that reason, it gets the coverage that it's gotten. And so for me,
the shorthand of that, just to say, is that what some will say is it's more newsworthy. Mm-hmm. And that sounds really crass to say that, but that a young 20-something attractive white woman
on
in South Boston
gets
is brutalized and murdered is news. It is not new or news, I guess people say, and it sounds incredibly crass, when yet another person of color who's poor, for example, is killed. And
but it's a universe. I mean, when I had an editor once at South End News, I believe that any violent attack belongs on page one of the South End News. You know, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. And before I was publisher, I had an editor who had a story of a woman who was killed by her male partner, and he had it inside the paper. And I said, "Why is it inside the paper?" And he said, "Well, it's just a domestic." You know. And that's the point of view that a lot of news, and this guy wasn't a bad guy. It's just, you know, how many people does it affect? Why do I care about it? And that's battle, you
Go
know?
Go ahead, Reverend.
Now, let me say this. You know, thinking that journalism is a business, you know, although I live in the black community and I work around these issues, as is well known, I'm not sure if I could make the argument as, you know, balancing ethics with business, that every death should be on the first page and that it constitutes news. One of the arguments made, which I'm not sure I would make, but I understand it, is that, as Jim said, you know, this was new, as in news. This does not normally happen. This is out of the ordinary. It's not more important than what happens to anyone else, but just in terms of journalism, this is very unusual and hence the story. And so I understand that position. In fact, that explanation was given to me by a black person who said, listen, is there maybe a double standard here in terms of the amount of attention and the amount of political response? That one could make that argument that the political response has been exceptional in contrast to what happens if you live in a poor neighborhood and you're a poor person. But I understand and the reasoning that this is new. This is news, and it's news because it's exceptional, as opposed to what happens in the inner city.
I would also take the point of view, though, as a woman, that it is a targeted attack on women, which tends to get, you know, more attention, as I believe it should, than attack on men. I mean, what happened to women, the sexual assaults and the sexual muggings that have happened to women in the past 12 months or so, especially over Beacon Hill in the North End, guys get beat up on the street on a regular basis, and it doesn't make news. So the fact that it's also, if we compare what happened versus maybe the most recent murders or deaths, which may be young men, I don't know, I haven't looked at the stats, the fact that it's, you know, continuing assault against, I'm not saying there's a group effort here to war on women sort of thing, but we are a minority, we are at higher risk, and it does represent that.
Yeah, Reverend, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jim.
Let me broach another thing with you. There's a headline on the front page of the Metro section of the Globe. You're in New Jersey. I don't know if you've seen it yet. Written by Wesley Lowry, Historic Diversity in Mayor's Race.
Yeah, I saw that.
The subheadline, but United Minority Vote Cold Unlikely. Unless I'm wrong, the last serious minority candidate for Mayor of Boston was 30 years ago, obviously Mel King. Now virtually half the field, six minority candidates running. And here's what Larry DeCaro, sort of the go-to guy in city politics, says. With so many minority candidates, it makes it harder for all of them. And the point being that the field has potential to be split. And then the underlying question is, what's in the subheadline? Will there be, can there be, a united minority community that decides Jane Doe or John Doe is our woman or guy? And we're going to unite behind them so that in a majority-minority city, we're going to have a minority mayor. That's not real, though, is it?
No. In fact, the reality is that the black community, the black and brown community, is not that organized or that disciplined to pull that stunt off. Now, let me say in fairness, I'm not sure if the white folks are.
I was going to say.
I'm not sure. If
they've never had a BG.
The gay people are. The gay people are very organized.
God bless them. Yes, they are. So my sense is that in South Boston would organize and unify if there was an other that they could paint as the opposition. So we would not organize for, but organize against. The black community, the black and brown community, It's simply not that disciplined and organized. And frankly, it's a statement about the poverty of leadership that we don't have some esteemed individuals that could call everybody in as elder statesmen or elder stateswomen and say, hey, y'all, listen, there's an opportunity for us to get this together. Let's make it happen. It did happen in Chicago with Harold Washington. But we don't have, that's not likely.
But that, I mean, but this assumes that the best candidate for the minority community would be a minority.
Well, the perfect person to broach it with is Eugene Rivers, who actually thought the best candidate in a three-person field to replace Jack Hart as the state senator from South Boston and Dorchester was not the minority candidate who ended up winning.
No, absolutely.
But the white candidate from one of the two white candidates from South Boston.
That's still my view. Now, let me go to the question. The issue that can be credibly raised is, do we need another Irish boy running the town, right? I'm not sure that that's necessarily good for the city. They're not of the Irishmen, they're all good men. They're not the sharpest knives in the drawer. They're certainly not the sharpest individual I've ever seen.
They'll be happy to hear you say that. Go ahead, Gene. Yeah.
Well, God bless them, right? But I think that Charlotte Golda Ritchie, who I support, and I just put my cards out on the table, is a competent person. I think she's got to pick up her game to be more competitive and be a bit more aggressive. But as Adrian Walker put very bluntly this morning in the Boston Globe,
let me read the opening paragraph of Adrian's piece. It's pretty clever. Charlotte Golda Ritchie was for an appointed Boston School Committee before she was against it, or rather open to the possibility of being against it, or something like that. So go ahead. I'm sorry, Reverend Rivers.
So let me say this. I think that there are some talented people of color who deserve a shot. And they're certainly as talented as they're intellectually and politically as their white counterparts. So all things being equal, I think that the city could benefit from a talented person of color to give a new perspective. And then if we've got a person of color who's a woman, that's still better for the city, just in terms of a new kind of sensibility. Because in Boston, politics is a contact sport. And it's very aggressive, and bringing a softer, more civilized edge with a little less testosterone than has been the case, I think, would be an improvement.
I'd like to see a little more contact, actually.
We could get it the first Jewish mayor.
Has there ever been a Jewish mayor?
I don't think there
has.
Mike Ross.
Yeah. That's right, of course.
He's not Irish.
I love Mike Ross. He's a great guy. But I'd still like to hear more of a feminist perspective, because I think that would improve the quality of discourse.
Okay.
Don't you agree? Right.
What did you just say? Don't what?
Don't you agree?
I do. I agree.
It's
100%.
Not my job to agree. Now, here, Gene Rivers, let's shift gears for a second. Yesterday afternoon on Boston.com, I read this stunning and depressing, but I guess, stunning to me. 4 in 5 Americans face near poverty, no work under Obama. 4 or 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least part of their lives, a sign of deteriorating economic security and an elusive American dream. The most interesting part of this was some of the questions it raised. It says more than 19 million whites fall below the poverty line of $23,000 for a family of four, accounting for more than 41% of the nation's destitute, nearly double the number of poor blacks. And the story goes on to broach the question is that one question is how public programs to lift the disadvantage should be best focused on the affirmative action that historically has tried to eliminate racial barriers seen as the major impediment to economic equality, or in light of the new data, simply on improving socioeconomic status for all, regardless of race. What case do you make based on these statistics, Gene Rivers?
Well, my view has been it's not either or, but both and. Race and class. That's always been my view. I thought the affirmative action thing that was benefiting overwhelmingly middle and upper middle class blacks was unfair, because and so my view was always race and class, and not just race. That was always my view for the last 30 years or so, right? Because I thought it was unfair to the poor white kid from South Boston, for example, in the Harvard cases I know, right? But you got a working class kid from South Boston who applies to Harvard, and then you got an upper-middle-class black kid right, whose grades may not be as good as the poor kid from South Boston, but they give it to the black upper middle class kid. My view was, I felt that that was wrong. I would give the seat to the working class white kid because, for me, in this case, an upper middle class black kid who can't get himself together to work hard should not, does not, is not owed a seat at Harvard University.
So, but it seems to me, Reverend Rivers, that what you're saying is, while your answer to the question was it should be a combination of race and socioeconomic status, you're basically, I think, saying it shouldn't be a matter of race. It should be socioeconomic status. And if you happen to be a poor or lower middle income black, then fine. But if you're a middle income or upper middle income black, then not so fine. So the primary determinant.
No, what I would say is that if I have two very poor individuals, right? Same socioeconomic status. One is white, the other is black.
Okay.
I'd give it to the black. You know why? Because when you look at there's data that indicates that white males with high school educations do better socioeconomically and occupationally than black males with college degrees.
You know, one of the more depressing parts of this story and these reports, Reverend, is you know, I think we would all like to see a world where the disparities between people have shrunk. And fortunately, in this case, we have, only not for the better. I mean, this is the opposite of the saying, you know, let's raise all boats. We seem
right.
to be sinking more boats, which is emblematic of the problems that middle class and lower class Americans of all stripes are facing. I mean, what are we going to do about this?
Both of you raise an interesting point. I actually had the opportunity to go out to Southern Ohio and gave a presentation years ago to a group of young white kids from trailer parks who had come from Appalachia. I walked in, I saw these absolutely cherubic white kids, and it broke my heart. And I was so touched by a level of poverty that I had never seen in my life. And it was so interesting to me because there were these black, you know, kind of, you know, upper middle class professionals that came in with their fancy cars at this event, and they were the elites. And the desperately poor were these Appalachian white kids. And I said to myself, wow, if I were living out here, I'd actually not be working with the upper middle class blacks. I'd be working with the poor in this, you know, in these Appalachian trailer parks to make a difference for the lives of these white kids. I mean, it completely blew my mind.
Well, you know, we see the world sort of from, you know, every day I have a bad day, I say to myself, I am in America. You know, I am a white woman. I can get, you know, I've got some gifts that have been given to me by accident of birth. And when you see someone who has entitlements or is, you know, is born white and male in America, and they are suffering by no fault of their own, you know,
exactly.
The system's broken.
Yeah,
you
know,
I mean, it's really that bad.
That's right. When the white dude is getting jacked
right,
up,
right.
You know, things ain't working right. That's absolutely right.
Thanks for your empathy, Reverend Rivers. Now, Gene, before we let you go, did you read this piece Bill Keller wrote in the New York Times profiling Obama? I want to read to you an excerpt from this because you and Marjorie and I discussed at some length the president's comments following the verdict in the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin thing two Fridays ago. Charles Ogletree, who I know is a good friend of yours, law professor at Harvard and a close ally of the president's and counselor to the president, known him for a quarter of a century. Here's what Ogletree said to the New York Times. It seems to me he threw caution to the wind, meaning Barack Obama. He opens up a whole new chapter of Obama. And then Keller goes on to say, you know, I found Obama's words moving in their emotional warmth and empathy. But if you go back and read them, these are his words.
Yeah.
Now that the heat of the moment has cooled, you'll see they're carefully measured, completely consistent with what he said in his public life. The warrior against racism, the critics on the right deplore and critics on the left demand, is nowhere to be found. Is Keller right or is Ogletree right?
Absolutely right. No, Keller is absolutely right. And in fact, Keller goes on to say in the article, and no one picked up his black responsibility deal, where he references the fact that the majority of blacks are killed by blacks, right? You know, because in Keller's piece, he references the fact that in the president's address, he actually says that, you know, and parenthetically. And so I think Keller is absolutely correct that Obama played it. It was always measured. He is never going to be the race warrior. And ultimately, I'll tell you the irony. The irony of Obama's position on race is really when you tease out all the major addresses that he's given, black people, y'all need to get it together and more effectively organize yourselves. Be better fathers. No, Obama's lying to black people, you know, is basically black people, you're in America, get it together and more effectively organize yourself.
Now, that's Reverend Rivers, yeah. when Charles Ogletree doesn't return your calls, you'll now know why. Is that, do you understand?
No. I love Tree, and I almost did a cartwheel with him when the president simply said.
Well, at least Bill Cosby will call him back now.
Reverend Rivers, it's a pleasure. Next week, I assume we'll see you in the studio. Reverend Rivers, live from Princeton, New Jersey. For whatever reason, we'll find out next week. Thanks, Reverend.
Thank you, Reverend. Bye. Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III joins us on Mondays at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Tune in tomorrow at 1 for Open Mic with Charlie Baker. Lawyers for Whitey Bulger acknowledge that he ran a lucrative criminal enterprise, taking in millions by way of gambling, extortion, and drug trafficking. Today, it's their job to defend Whitey against those crimes and 19 charges of murder. Adam Riley joins us from the Moakley Courthouse with an update on how the defense team did today. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When it comes to healthcare, the mouth isn't always considered part of the body.
You know, we have a long history of separating oral healthcare from overall healthcare. Dental care is a very marginalized issue.
And for MassHealth patients, dental care comes or goes with each budget. I'm reporter Ibi Caputo. That story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell sitting in for Marjorie Egan, who will return tomorrow. I am Jim Browdy. You know, scientists used to think the shortest measurable unit of time was a nanosecond. Well, they may be wrong. It may be the time it takes for Whitey Bulger's lawyers to present his defense. Oh, and will he testify? Here to address all that live from the Moakley Courthouse, the scene of the trial, would be WGBH's Adam Riley. Hey, Adam.
Hey, guys. Jim, I wasn't sure where you were going with the nanosecond thing, but then you brought it back to Bulger. Now I understand.
Am I right?
It may be brief.
Yeah. So today's the first day of defense, and it sounds or looks from your Twitter feeds as if it looks like a mess.
A bit of a rough start for Whitey Bulger's defense team today. We only heard from one witness. Actually, the government isn't even done cross-examining yet. The witness called by the defense to start off their case was a man named Robert Fitzpatrick, who used to be an assistant special agent in charge at the Boston FBI and has described in a book called Betrayal his attempts to shut Whitey Bulger down as an informant and kind of bring the Boston FBI and the national FBI to its senses as far as Bulger was concerned. So let me give you a quick overview of how Fitzpatrick's testimony went today. Under gentle questioning from Hank Brennan, the excellent attorney for Bulger's team, or one of the excellent attorneys for his team, Fitzpatrick, you know, was very, very chatty on the stand, talked about growing up in an orphanage in New York, talked about getting started in the FBI and building this amazing career that brought him in connection with things like the Abscam thing. You remember that. He was a really good storyteller, had all these great details about the Abscam thing. Talked about cultivating informants who helped him prevent a KKK bombing of a synagogue. And again, the detail he offered was just incredibly riveting and continued to be riveting as he talked about meeting Bulger for the first time as a sort of the number two or number three agent in the Boston FBI, realizing immediately that Bulger was no good, being stunned when in this meeting with Bulger, that was supposed to be a one-on-one meeting, John Connolly popped out of nowhere. in Bulger's condo in Quincy. And then he talked about, you know, trying to get the powers that be in the FBI in Boston, even not in the FBI in Boston, Bill Weld, then the U.S. attorney, Jeremiah O'Sullivan, then the head of the New England Organized Crime Strike Force team, trying to get them to realize that Bulger was bad, trying to get them also to provide witness protection to Brian Haller, one of Bulger's
last victims. This guy sounds like a hero. Right? He's a hero, this guy,
he
right?
Absolutely heroic. He sounded like exactly what you'd want a whistleblower to be. So this went on for a long, long time. And then the rest of the day, but by far the more memorable part of the day, was taken up by Brian Kelly, the assistant U.S. attorney who's helping the government prosecute Bulger. He got up, and he, all I can tell you is, he completely ripped Robert Fitzpatrick's credibility to shreds. He cast him in the course of, you know, maybe an artful half hour or 45 minutes as basically a compulsive liar. Listen to some of the things that Kelly essentially convinced everyone in the courtroom, myself included, that Robert Fitzpatrick has lied about. He seems to have lied about arresting Jerry Angiulo, the former mafia boss here in Boston. And Kelly read from this, you know, very purple prose part of Fitzpatrick's book, in which he talked about, you know, slapping the cuffs on Angiulo as the pasta stains on his clothing mixed with the blood draining from his face. Just this really terrible, hackneyed writing. And it turns out that, according to FBI reports, that's not how it happened at all. Robert Fitzpatrick also claims to have been the man, the one man, who found the rifle that was used to kill Martin Luther King. Again, according to official FBI reports, that's not what actually happened. The rifle was found by a couple Memphis cops. And he claimed to be present at the exhumation of the body of John McIntyre, one of Bulger's alleged victims, a murder that figures in this case, represented in his book that he was there for the exhumation, and it turns out that he wasn't. And it was almost poignant to watch this guy on the stand under cross, because I think I said a while back when we were watching Stephen Fleming testify and be crossed by Hank Brennan, you got the impression that he really didn't know what the truth was. He honestly had no idea what truth meant anymore. And I got to say, Patrick taking the stand for the defense, you got the same impression. He seemed like a man who just makes stuff up and doesn't really know what happened, what's authentic, and what's embellishment. And it was painful at the point.
So,
you know,
Adam,
a lot of us were chuckling, but it got grisly to watch.
So, Adam, this is the good start for the defense. Do they have anything? What we've read over the weekend is this potentially could have been a couple of days. Obviously, the extended cross-examination may change that. But I guess two questions. Do they have anything here is based on what you can see? And two, the tiredest question in all of New England, is there any inclination that Bulger is going to take the stand?
Yeah, let me start with two. I mean, everyone, myself included, is speculating and theorizing about whether Bulger is going to testify. My own take, and I may have mentioned this on here before, I don't really know why he wouldn't. I mean, they've conceded most of the case against him. There are strong signs that he's going to die in prison. I don't know why he wouldn't want to take the stand and kind of offer his own definitive
account of what
happened on his own behalf, except maybe he's afraid of being embarrassed. Maybe his mental faculties aren't all that sharp. Other than that, I don't know why he wouldn't testify, but I don't think anyone really knows. In terms of whether the defense has anything, you know, they're going to call some former FBI agents who are going to try to speak, as Fitzpatrick did today, not too effectively, to the sort of general climate of corruption in the FBI and maybe in the DOJ during Bulger's heyday. But the thing is, the defense has already done a really good job cross-examining the government's witnesses to make that same point as the government presented its case. So I'm not really sure that they're going to have any sort of fantastic witnesses who helped them even more than the cross-examinations of John Martorano or Stephen Slemy or Kevin Weeks did. I think we may have already seen the defense's best stuff, to be honest.
And from what I understand, after the judge in this case pared down the defense witness list, the maximum number, I believe, if I recall, the maximum number they were allowed to call was, what, 16? Was that what the number was?
I had 16 in my head as well, so that's good. It makes me think that I may have actually been right.
After
what they were initially talking about. Some other big names are conspicuously absent, like, you know, for example, Bill Weld. It would have been fascinating to hear Bill Weld talk about the relationship between the U.S. Attorney's Office and Bulger, but we're not going to.
By the way, and you know, what's particularly interesting about that, and I guess this what Jay Carney or his co-counsel would say is the reason we're not calling him is because we're precluded from getting into the infamous immunity defense. Is Bill Weld said in an interview with the Boston Herald editorial board, and I'm paraphrasing, so I don't want to do a disservice to what Weld said. He said, well, he had no direct knowledge, because obviously he was there at the time of Jeremiah O'Sullivan and all this sort of thing. He said, well, I was not privy to any discussions with Whitey Bulger. He said something like, I wouldn't rule out the notion that they could have had those discussions. So I assume he was on the list, one, for PR value, and two, to deal with an immunity defense, which has obviously disappeared. You know, Adam, one last thing.
Actually, just let me jump in for 1 second. You know, my perennial caveat when I talk about this stuff is that I'm speaking as a close observer, but not an attorney. But just as a layperson, I really didn't understand Judge Denise Casper's refusal to let the defense
immunity
argument. I mean, the gist seemed to be, well, even if Jeremiah O'Sullivan hypothetically did grant Whitey Bulger immunity, it would have been illegal, so he couldn't have done it. And therefore, we're not supposed to hear about it? I mean, that doesn't pass the smell.
Well, there's another reason, Adam. I am sort of a lawyer, and so my sense was that as to why it was unwise, and I'm sure we'll get email after this saying that I don't know what I'm talking about, is having followed the case secondhand, unlike you being there most of the time, that seems to be the only credible basis for appeal of a guilty verdict in this case.
That's a good point.
Why not take it away? Why not let him tell this preposterous story that virtually no one, I assume, is going to believe? Let the jury reject it, which I am assuming they would do. And then the spectrum of things that can go up to a higher court post-conviction, assuming there is a conviction, are limited to technical decisions made by the court, procedural decisions. So I have to say, I never really got it. One last question, Adam. Is there anybody on the witness, other than Bulger himself, who, again, we don't know about, is there anybody on the witness list of the remaining 15 who has firepower? I mean, somebody who has got a big profile or nobody?
You know, I think the closest we would have come would have been the mother of Deborah Hussey, Marion Hussey. Mm-hmm. But we heard today that she is sick with terminal brain cancer and is incapable of taking the stand. So given her close relationship with Flemmy and how important Flemmy is to the government's case, she would have been fascinating to hear from, but we're not going to. So, I think the best has already come. We may get, John Martirano taking the stand again briefly. So maybe someone like that who comes back after testifying for the government. But the big names have pretty much worked their way through this thing already.
That is Adam Riley. He is essentially our camera and microphone down there at the Moakley Courthouse. Adam, thanks as always. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys. Talk to you later.
Adam Riley is, he's just, like Jim said, he's the man on the ground. It's kind of like gathering around the radio and listening to your soap opera. Only real things are happening. Well, The Wolverine is the latest X-Men spinoff, and it's hoping to claw back some Hollywood pride after a string of huge big-budget flops this summer. Will this be another broken blockbuster? Film critic Garen Daly joined us to go over the Hollywood pathology and why they keep making billion-dollar flops. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Whitey Bulger trial is a tangle of informants and hitmen, FBI agents, and innocent bystanders. Visit our website at WGBHnews.org, where you can follow live trial updates from reporters Philip Martin and Adam Riley, plus see our Bulger timeline and an outline of who's who in the proceedings. That's all online at WGBHnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Bryant University's Graduate School of Business, offering part-time and full-time MBA programs preparing leaders to meet the demands of the global marketplace. Information session on August 1st. Details at bryant.edu. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988. Located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at groganco.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Sue O'Connell is sitting in for Marjorie Egan. Marjorie will return tomorrow. You know, in Tinseltown this summer of 2013, it may be remembered as the summer of the broken blockbusters. Sue Cole, After Earth, White House Down, The Lone Ranger. Just a few examples of the films which bombed at the box office this year. Joining us to go over the summer's flops, the greatest flops in film history, and why Hollywood continues to pour big money into colossal failures is film critic Garen Daly. He's also the director and producer of the forthcoming documentary, which I cannot wait for, The Orson Welles Complex. Garen, good to see you again.
Hi, guys.
It's an exciting time in the movie industry, isn't it?
You know, it's sort of like the best of times and the worst of times.
You know, before we get into it, do you want to talk a little bit, just as a kind of primer, about why, you know, we're going to talk in the big why, but why they're making these big budget movies? I understand, you know, the revenue stream is all messed up and the Netflix and the international market, that's got to play part of this.
Oh, it's a really complex problem, right. But the ultimately gets down to a little catchphrase, and that is there's no success like excess. And it's true. When you look at something like the Iron Man 3, it grossed $1.2 billion worldwide, and it cost $250 to make. So think about all the money they made. So everyone is seeing those dollar signs in their eyes, and they're just being stupid.
And the other part of it, I think, too, and this, you might correct me on this because you know more about the economy, how it relates to movies, but I know when I go out to a movie, you know, I want to spend money and I know it's going to be well spent. You know, if I'm going to pay for the popcorn and see the movie, I want to see something, if I'm going as the grown-up, with something that's been well reviewed that I think I'll like, or with my kid that we'll both like. Otherwise, I'm just going to stay at home and wait till I see it on TV.
Well, that's a problem. There is a lot of competition.
On my big TV.
And, you know, and believe me, Hollywood needs to be looking at cable right now, mm-hmm. because when you think about the comic book films and what they represent, and then you look at something like Game of Thrones, it's a completely different world. In the comic book world, no one ever really dies because they can somehow come back to life and there can be another sequel. But in Game of Thrones, everybody dies.
Okay, let's talk about a film that I was convinced was going to be huge, which is a total flop from the summer. This is from The Lone Ranger. In this scene, Tonto, obviously Johnny Depp, is presenting The Lone Ranger with his signature mask. Listen up.
Eyes cut by the bullets that killed him. From the great beyond, he will protect you. And the ones you love.
You want me to wear a mask?
The men you seek think you are dead, Kimosabe. Better to stay that way.
All right. But if we ride together, it's to bring these men to justice in a court of law. Is that understood?
But if we ride together, it's to bring these men to justice. Is that understood? Now we know why that was a colossal flop. Now, if you had said to me, Johnny Depp, as a, let's assume I was a producer or a big funder, Johnny Depp, they essentially are going to create this Western version of what he made $16 trillion for the industry and all those, that series of movies from
Pirates,
what, a couple
of
Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah.
Caribbean. I would have said, this is going to be huge. You would have said early on that I was wrong even before the fact?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because the last Lone Ranger was a dog. Westerns don't necessarily make it. And you've changed the focus from Lone Ranger to Tonto. And all of a sudden, you've got a completely different movie.
Yeah, but you know, you're a smart guy. You're not that much smarter than everybody else, Garen. So how do they, I mean that in the most loving way. How do the boys and girls with the billions of dollars not know what you know? How could they not have known that?
Well, again, what we're looking at here is the fact that Johnny Depp did make billions of dollars for these people, and he was behind this project, as was Gore Verbinski, who directed this film, as well as the Pirates of the Caribbean films. So there is this feeling in Hollywood that you can't diss somebody who has made you lots of money. So you give them their vanity projects. You know, and there are plenty of bombs across the Hollywood landscape of vanity projects that tanked. This is a vanity project that tanked. And you know what? It didn't have to. The problem with this film is it's just really, as you were saying when you were quoting that thing, it is just incredibly poorly written. And the area that Hollywood is cutting back its money on is development, trying to vet these films before they get made.
That's the voice of Garen Daly. We're discussing Hollywood flops, both of the summer, like The Lone Ranger. In a minute, we're going to talk about some of the great flops of all time. Our number is 877-301-8970. I'd like to hear from somebody who has seen a movie where the consensus was, this is one of the biggest flops of all time, both financially, critically, etc., but you loved it. and make the case that the theater goers and the critics were wrong. What are the big, give us a couple of the huge flops from history.
Well, I mean, there's always Ishtar, Heaven's Gate.
Ishtar was Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty.
Right, another vanity project. Heaven's Gate, where a director who made one big film comes back and tries to make something even bigger, and it's just over his
head. Now, Heaven's Gate, am I wrong that there has been a recut of it that actually shows that it's a good movie if it had been re-edited? Did I make that up?
No. It has been re-edited, yep. And it is getting a kind of a revisionist look on
okay.
it. But it's not burning up the box.
Came back as the Titanic. That's what it came back as.
But every movie that has a big budget that people are huge, I don't mean a ridiculous budget, and people are worried about gets compared to Heaven's Gate still.
That's correct.
To this day.
It's considered
Avatar,
the bomb.
Heaven's, yeah.
The bomb, yeah.
So, but there's a surprise on this list. When you first were talking to Chelsea, our lead producer, about this, the list of flops from all time, there's a movie that's right up there that probably is one of the favorite movies of 50% of the people who are listening to the show. What would that be?
That would be Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz. I thought you were going to mention It's a Wonderful Life.
No, well,
Wizard of Oz was a flop, too.
Wizard of Oz, when it came out in 1939, was up against amazing competition. 1939 is considered the year for Hollywood. So Wizard of Oz never really found its audience when it first came out. It was only subsequently that it became.
It was like
out.
The fried green tomatoes of its time.
Yes.
And is that the, so wait, is that the same thing with – why did It's a Wonderful Life not – why wasn't
well,
it as was, huge
it's,
then
it's,
as it is now?
It's a Wonderful Life has a really unique history. First of all, back in those days, films started off in New York with one or two theaters. And when It's a Wonderful Life opened, there was a big blizzard, and nobody went and saw it, and the ads, the reviews got killed. So it died. And if it didn't do well in New York, it didn't do well any other place. And then what happened is its rights lapsed, and it became public domain, and everyone was showing it on TV, and that's how everyone got to know
it. And plus, it was ahead of its time. It was a sort of counterculture revolutionary movie
Standing up to the man, Mr. Potter.
Yeah,
well, actually, speaking of that, this scene, George Bailey, Jimmy Stewart, brilliant, I should say, railing against the banking titan, Mr. Potter.
You said that what did you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait for what? Until their children grow up and leave them? Until they're so old and broken down that you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be.
As Chelsea just said in my ear, compare that writing to the writing of Lone Ranger. I mean, it is so true.
And the acting, too. Yeah. Lionel Barrymore is so good
so
in that
great film.
I mean, the acting is great all the way across.
Now, Garen, I'm going to test your knowledge once again.
Oh, God.
All of us, all the producers, the talent, as we are called, we did some research this morning.
Uh-huh.
Do you happen to know what the movie is that lost more money, meaning its expenses exceeded its intake, than any movie in the history of Hollywood, according to every source we Now, I'll give you a hint. This is a movie that every single one of us, except one intern, had never even heard of, and it was made just 2 years ago. Do you have any idea?
Wow, I would say Rest in Peace or R.I.P.D., which is now was probably going to be one of
afraid
the big
not,
ones.
No.
Then my first
it's animated.
It's animated?
Should I play you the clip?
Yeah, play
I'll play
the
clip before
the clip.
I tell you.
Yeah, let's not embarrass me anymore.
This is a 2011 Disney movie. I'm not going to tell you the name of it until you hear the clip. Here it is.
Welcome to Mars. My name is Grimma. This is Two Cats. What's your handle?
Milo.
How about I call you my bro? Check it.
What is going on?
Okay, that's
this
enough of that.
Mars
needs
moms. Yeah.
Now, I was stunned by that. Lost $140 million. Why was that such a – it's a Disney film.
Because, again, they were trying to do things that was outside of their real bailiwick, and they did, and it was a bad movie, written.
You know, I got to say, when you go to the and you see the previews and you think it's a bad preview, it's going to be a bad movie.
Right.
I mean, at this level. I mean, because if they can't make a decent preview by telling you everything that's going to happen in the movie, it's really going to bomb. I remember seeing the Mars Needs Moms preview
over and over.
And I didn't understand what it was about.
Well, you know, the other part of it is
I mean,
that
I
you
get
have,
from the title.
There are truisms
I mean.
in the business, and one of them is never, ever title a film with Mars in it because it bombs.
Well, you know what? It's funny.
John
because
Carter.
John Carter. Let's talk about John Carter for a second.
That
by the
poor
way,
boy.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Pick a great flop from the history of movies. It could be from this summer, if you like. If it's The Lone Ranger, that's fine. And tell us why the critics and the theater goers were dead wrong. The film was great. Now, John Carter, the star of the John Carter, whose name I don't even know, was
Taylor
fabulous.
Kitsch.
Right. In one of the great television series of all time. Friday Night Lights was brilliant. All the acting was brilliant. The stories were great. This was one of the colossal flops ever, right?
It was a colossal flop, but, you know, if you do take a look at it to kind of prod your listeners a little bit, it's not that bad. Mm-mm. And I kind of enjoyed it.
So what happened?
I think what happened
was... about him going to another planet or something? What was
it? Yeah, it's based on the Edgar Rice Burroughs story of the same name, and it's about him, an Earthman circa 1870, going to Mars and fomenting revolution and fighting on the good side.
You know, they were thinking, instead of naming it John Carter, they were going to name it Mars Needs Moms, but they decided it wasn't going to work. But God, I'm sorry. So why was it so? Why was it?
I think
so
that what happened is it caught a river of bad news, and so it was expected to be a bad film, and therefore it was a bad film.
Our number is 877-301-8970.
If it had not been Disney, too, I mean, you know, the expectation.
Oh, that was a Disney, too?
Yeah, of some of these films get so high, and then when it's got bad news, there's no way it can have a reasonable finish. Plus the budget issue, too.
Right.
If they didn't spend that much on it, it wouldn't have been that big a flop. It probably would have been a mediocre box office,
people were waiting for John Lasseter to get his comeuppance. John Lasseter being the producer of the Pixar films. And this was his baby project. And people kind of think really we're looking to...
But how do people... You know, one of the dynamics... And I promise we'll get to the calls in about 30 seconds. One of the dynamics I never understand... If tons of people go to a movie on the first couple of days... More often than not, even if the word of mouth is not good, it seems to sustain itself. How is it that a movie like that, with a very attractive male lead, a guy who was a huge star on this celebrated series, how did people decide not to go in the beginning? They didn't want to punish the director. They didn't even know who the director is. Why did no one go to it?
Because it got bad news, and
the audience
is, you know, it does follow the crowd. But remember, the thing is, even if it tanks in the United States, they're doing 70% more globally, so they don't really care.
How did Mars Needs Moms do overseas? Did it do well?
I think it was like someplace out beyond Pluto.
Right, but at some point we're going to see that on the Disney Channel over and over and over again. So it will fulfill some niche of the budget item.
But it will never make the money back.
True.
I mean, it's not like Cars, which made great money, but made even more money. Five times as much money with tchotchkes and blankets and stuff.
That's true. I forgot about the whole. I always forget about the Disney part of the merchandising. And
let's go to Herb in Boston. We're looking for people who are going to sing the praises of a Hollywood flop. Hello there, Herb.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
I would have to say Cabin in the Woods. This movie was directed by Josh Goddard and written by, actually produced by Josh Whedon, of course, from The Avengers. And it was a satirical look at horror, and it was extremely intelligently written, turned, you know, horror movie cliches on its axis. And, you know, it was a very entertaining movie, and it showcased a lot of talent from a lot of unknown actors and did horrible at the box office.
Well, Herb, let's see if Garen's with you on this. How about a Garen Daly?
I actually will disagree with him a little bit. I mean, I have to take a look at how much it cost versus how much it made, but it has become a cult classic already.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Chris Hemsworth is in it, one of the young talent that was in there. And it's a film that has done very, very well on DVD. So it may not have done incredibly well at the box office, but it still is going to be making money. And something to remember about horror films, when you take a look at something like The Conjuring, which did very well last weekend, these films are being made for $20 million. Yeah. They only have to make $40 million in box office before they start really rolling in the money.
Herb, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Jay. You're in, I'm not sure where you are, but we're glad to have you. Hey, Jay.
Hey, I'm in Rockland.
Hey, Rockland.
I just wanted to shoot out real quick with you talking about things that started off as a flop. Originally, Scarface. Because of all of the controversy, you know, in the box office, not many people were watching it, and it came out in 83. It was like number 32 for that week of all movies. And now, you know, once it went on video, people were more willing to watch it at home, and now it's like a cult classic.
This is Al Pacino we're talking about. Why was it? What was the controversy when it was when it first came out, Jay?
Well, it was so violent. Oh. They had to repeatedly go back and cut scenes, cut language. You know, the chainsaw scene that's famous, you know, had to be redone again and again. And, you know, it was just, it had NC-17, just trying to get into a rating that would allow it into a major theater was a struggle. So people already knew, like, oh, this is, you know, kind of like a, like it had just had a bad name for
Got
me.
It.
So, yeah.
Jay, thanks. What I mean, is that your recollection?
It's actually
of your
a pretty good. That's a pretty good representation of that film. It, you know, and again, eventually, it did make lots of money on DVD. But it, you know, that violent, that rating, that bad news approach to it. Remember the Warriors in 1971? I think it came out 1970-71. It was considered a remarkably violent mm-hmm. film, and people were afraid of it. And I was actually running a theater in Los Angeles, and we got these long lists of instructions about what to do and what not to do. Now we take a look at it, and it's like. Really?
So right. tame, you mean?
They're showing yeah. it on, you know, the children's hour at 8 a.m. What about Beloved?
Was that
considered a flop? I mean, that didn't
well,
really...
You know, here it wasn't considered a flop, but here's something. Hollywood doesn't like to call things flops.
Right.
You know, Variety will do it. What they like to say is something
underperformed. You hear that a lot, don't you, Jim?
Yeah, exactly. I've heard it more than I'd like to.
But
thank
it's,
you for
but
that.
It's, but it, what that says is they are refusing to admit... that the artistic side and the craftsman side and the artisan side of things is an integral part of making a movie. They just think if they make a product, market it really, really well, they're going to make their money back. So if it doesn't do it, it underperforms.
Let's give us an example in the last, let's say, handful of years, 5-6 years, of a, quote, underperforming movie that deserved far better. It was really great.
Oh, boy.
Of the bigger one. I mean, you can think about it for a second. Let's take a call and think about it for a minute. Let's go to Manchester, where Mike is on with Garen Daly. We're talking about Hollywood flops. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
Good, good. I am going to go pretty far back here. This was 1989, and it's for people who are fans of this director, you know, it's just one of the greatest films you've ever seen in your life. But Terry Gilliam's The Adventures of Baron Munchausen was, if I remember correctly, it was the most expensive film until Terminator 2 came out, and they spent all their money making it. They literally made a town in Italy that they had to destroy, and it's to this day is one of my favorite movies. And my, you know, and everybody that I show it to, my kids and everything, they love it, and they can't believe that nobody's ever heard of this movie. But
why did it not go? Mike, thanks for the call. Why did it not go, Garen?
Too smart.
Really?
Really
too smart?
Yeah. Way, way too smart. That's the one thing about, I mean, Gilliam sometimes goes overboard with his excesses as a director. But Baron Munchausen, as Mike said, is really a very, very good film that deals with some very interesting concepts. And Gilliam did a very good job about putting that film together.
How about every Madonna movie except Desperately Seeking Susan?
Well, that wasn't a Madonna film.
That was a Susan Sidham film. But every Madonna film, I remember in the 80s, we would, you know, be all excited. Evita, I guess, was not a flop, but there was who's that girl and the one on the beach that she made her husband.
Geely, yeah. And then there's the Seven Beauties.
Was it, yeah, I don't know. Just, but Madonna just is.
You know, speaking of locally and stars, wasn't Ben Affleck the king of the flop until all of a sudden he became
this huge.
It's not just Geely. What did he make? 1942 or whatever.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Everything
one.
He
Pearl
touched
Harbor.
Turned
yeah.
to you know what.
And yeah,
Pearl Harbor.
Again, what is really interesting about Ben Affleck's career is that he started off making small films. He got into his head that he was an action adventure star and really sucked into the Hollywood.
Because of J-Lo. J-Lo told him that. That's Jennifer Lopez, Jim, in case you don't know. J-Lo.
Thank you.
But he got back grounded and he started doing things. And look, Ben Affleck is a go-to director now.
Yeah.
He really
Well, you've won, your picture's won an Academy Award, even if you didn't get nominated for director, and obviously you're
going to
be there,
But
right?
if there's a production in problem, they're going to either Ben Affleck or, believe it, Carrie Fisher to make corrections.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Carrie Fisher's been, like, you probably don't know this,
Carrie
Jim.
Fisher,
she
like Queen,
been,
what's her name? Carrie
been,
Fisher.
Princess Leia.
She has been rewriting scripts uncredited.
Right.
You know,
Is that true?
Yeah, any script that's like, you know, should be funnier and isn't, and they don't want to bring her in as
How do you
named.
Know that, by the way?
I don't know why I know these things. Carrie Fisher, and there's a couple of others that...
Right.
Right. would know. They come in and rewrite
script
the jokes.
Script doctors.
Yep, script doctors.
Hey, speaking of doctors, you are doing this great documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. There's a website, right? Is there not?
OWComplex.com.
And you can contribute to it. You can learn much. When is it coming out?
April 2014.
It is getting closer and closer.
Tell me about it.
I like
it.
How you said that. Daly. April!
It's great to see you. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Browdy.
Great to see you. Tomorrow it's Open Mic with Charlie Baker. We're also going to talk about the latest research on obesity, suggesting that for many, it could be in the genes. I am Jim Browdy. She is Sue O'Connell. Marjorie Egan will be back tomorrow. Hope you are too. See you at noon. Bye.